This is Justice Matters with Tim Buxton, coming to you from Yugambeh country of the Kommonberry people of the Gold Coast, Australia. I'm your host, Tim, where my sole aim is to share conversations I get to have with inspiring people doing remarkable work to create a world where we all belong. This podcast is brought to you by the Just Travel Company. Experience wonder and unearth justice and discover the just way to travel today. Visit just-travel.co. Without further ado, here's our guest for this episode of Justice Matters.
Oh man, this is so fun.
Yes. John Richmond from, well, I was going to say near Richmond, Virginia, but that's really not anywhere near where you are. You're in Washington, D.C. You are the ambassador at large, which I really need to ask you about what at large even means. It kind of sounds like an interesting clarification for being an ambassador. For the U.S. for human trafficking, or the monitoring of and evaluation of human trafficking throughout the U.S. and the world, representing the U.S. and lived in India. We'll get into that, working with incredible organizations like International Justice Mission, and a friend. Welcome to the Justice Matters podcast.
It's so good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So right at the get-go, I've rattled off a few things. Can you explain you, your role? You're obviously a lawyer as well, so that kind of feeds on into it. But yeah, give us your intro to our wonderful guests today.
Absolutely. Well, so I served as the United States ambassador at large to monitor and combat trafficking in persons. It's a long title. One thing I learned in Washington is that the amount of influence you wield is inversely proportional to the length of your title. So the long words do not mean a lot of power or influence. But I think it is interesting to think about. Most ambassadors are an ambassador in residence, an ambassador that goes from one country to another country and then represents that country on any issues that might come up. But in addition to ambassadors in residence, the United States has 6 ambassadors at large. We have one for global criminal justice. We have one for HIV and AIDS, counterterrorism, things like that. And in the year 2000, our Congress elevated the issue of human trafficking to also have an ambassador at large position. So not an ambassador to one country, but to everywhere, but not on all topics, just on one specific topic. And so I'm grateful that I spent most of my career thinking about these ideas of freedom and justice. Think about the idea of how could we bring people who are currently being exploited into a life where they can flourish.
Yeah. Wow. That's so fascinating. I mean, having served in diplomatic roles, I'm sure there's so much you could help us like unravel behind the scenes of what sometimes, you know, you feel like you're being educated by the West Wing, but there's so much more to it. And I think it's 2000, I think about where the world was just before 9/11. There was a lot of issues going on, but the fact that you know, an issue which for so often has gone a lot of ways unsighted, it's not overtly, I think it thrives off the fact that it's so overtly and nefariously run behind the scenes. To be given that kind of prominence and to have people dedicated to working, but it didn't begin there for you. You obviously had served in other roles, and I'd love to kind of, you know, trace back your journey into, you know, what does it take for someone to find themselves representing the U.S. in that role? Like, where did it all begin for you? Maybe even before your time in India, maybe like as a child, I'd love to just learn your passion for justice, your freedom. I've spent a lot of time with you and it's just, you know, you're obviously bent on serving those and giving freedom, like you said, to those that are trapped is a core part of who you are. So where did it begin?
That's a great question. I think I was raised in just a wonderful family. My mom and dad are great examples of people that love each other and are just simple, thoughtful, hardworking folks. And, you know, my older brother and I grew up, I think, with a sense that we were loved, and that the issues of the world were real and that they mattered. I feel like we always had a sense that we wanted to see things that were wrong, and we wanted to work to make them right. And, you know, when I went to university, my philosophy professor just could not define justice, just bent himself into an intellectual pretzel, trying to say there's no definition to what justice is. And I came to realize that I think justice is simply making wrong things right. Like whether it's a big thing or a small thing, a local thing or a global thing, it's picking up litter, it's pulling weeds out of a garden and creating order, it's seeing something wrong to make it right, it's listening to the elderly neighbor tell their stories one more time just to let them know they matter. You know, but it's also engaging on the big issues of the day. It's asking ourselves, you know, if we really believe that everybody has value, that there's human dignity in every single person, that their individual designation is so much more important than their group identities. If we really believe that, how do we love? How do we show, how do we make things right for people who are suffering in drought or refugee or conflict areas or victims of crime, like trafficking victims? Like, how do we want to engage as a culture and as a community and as individuals? And so as I grew up, ultimately went to law school and practiced for a number of years. And there was an opportunity that came about to move to India and to try to work full time on this issue of people who are forced to work, that there is someone who's actually exploiting them and controlling them. They don't get to make the most basic decisions about their lives. Mm. They don't get to decide when they wake up or where they work or who touches their bodies. There's a sense that that's wrong. And could there possibly be something that we could do? And so my wife and I moved with our 15-month-old daughter. And my wife was actually pregnant at the time that we shifted from the United States to India. And we were clueless, Tim. We had no idea what we were doing. But we were full of passion and excitement and curiosity and a willingness to try and learn from folks who were already there and try to understand the culture and the context and to see if there was some way that we could come alongside folks and try to improve the situation.
Had you been to India before? Had you been on a visit or had your wife been?
I'd visited India twice before, but my wife had never been. Like sight unseen.
Dude, it's crazy. She must love you. Let me just tell you that. Like, it's a huge thing to move state or to move countries, but to go from a radically, you know, I love India. It's probably one of my favorite countries in the world to visit. There's just so much like you get the full, everything on full spectrum right there from the taste to the sights, to the sounds, to the people. And they're very generous, but it's a lot different to Washington, D.C. Let me put it that way, or to the U.S.
It is in many, many ways, and it's definitely an incredible, vibrant place. I loved it there, and we have great friends. It was fun to build an office and to build a team and build a model for replicable, sustainable work, and to learn what that meant. And there was so many failures along the way, so many successes as well, but lots to learn from, and was so taken by just the teachability of all the folks involved, the sense of we know where we want to head. We're not quite sure how to get there. And if we make a mistake, we're going to fail forward and try to learn from that and keep going on. But if we could keep the relationships as the number one thing, if we could make sure that we're always trying to be intentionally relational and never transactional with people.
Wow. I love that. It's almost like a value. I've been coining some values again for my own organization, and I'm going to steal that. You know, you've been doing it for a long time. Relationship over being relational, not transactional. Because that's the hardest stuff, right? It's easy to just get in and make a contract and list it all down. What's difficult is to wade into the messiness of feelings and emotions and people's, what they bring to the table, and you know, even in a contract, everyone can read that a different way. Right? Mm-hmm. They can read words. There's nothing like a text message that one person sends thinking they're being real clear, but they're just, they did not read what you intended to write, you know? So I love that relational emphasis. And how important is that when you're working cross-culturally, right? Because mm-hmm. there's a lot of misunderstandings.
No, I think it's so important in that context just to be constantly make generous assumptions, you know, about people's motives, about what people meant. You know, if they send that text message or email and it could be read one of multiple ways, like just assume it's the most generous possible motive behind it.
Yes.
You know, if someone's really trying to be mean to you, they'll circle back and let you know. They'll come back and with a sharper blow if they really want. But so often they're just in a hurry. They're trying to do something else at the same time. They're just firing something off. But if we could, you know, we want to be generous in so many different areas of our lives. But I think if we could have generosity about other people's assumptions and motivations, I think we would avoid a lot of unnecessary conflict.
Oh, absolutely. I want to circle back to what you were saying earlier when you talked about you were a lawyer. And because, you know, the irony is that there's this other podcast called Justice Matters out there. It has far more views than me. I think we started at the same time. I think at the very beginning, you know, when you typed in Justice Matters on Spotify, mine came up first. Now there's not a chance I'm going to compete with this guy. He's like this lawyer out of somewhere in the East Coast of the US, and he's doing all this stuff on the greatest, you know, all the big law things, what lawyers talk about in big fancy stuff. But anyways, he's really popular. But the idea is justice is this gavel thing, you know, like we're making a judgment. It's a judge thing. And you know, this idea of, you know, that being an aspect of it and an important part of, like, hey, this is how we make something right by, you know, here's the consequences for your actions, or here's the, you know, the judgment on whether or not it was fair or right or needs to be taken account for. But can you help kind of share? I mean, the question would be, how did you make that transition, or how have you integrated both the lawyer side of justice and the maybe the more, like we're talking about, the more relational, personal, messy side of justice?
I appreciate the question, Tim, because I think often justice gets reduced down or even caricatured as just accountability. It's just holding people accountable. That's justice. But I would suggest that that's a part of it, and sometimes it's necessary. But I really do think it's much broader than that. It's accountability plus restoration. It's accountability plus understanding the consequences and the collateral issues. If we're going to work to make wrong things right, we're trying to reorient the situation back into the way it was intended to be. And we can't always do that. You know, if someone commits a murder, right, we can hold someone accountable. We can never bring that person who's now deceased back into life. But we can work to try to make those wrong things right. It's just going to require accountability, but it's also going to require some mercy. It's going to require some appreciation for the consequences of if someone has been assaulted, if someone has suffered a trauma. That's going to take some time to walk through. Yeah, it's going to take years of processing that and thinking about it and understanding how that could trigger another event in the future. But if I just think it's got to be more than just accountability, but at the same time, there are some groups out there that just want to delete all accountability. And I think that's a different error in the opposite direction.
That. Yeah. We can't do that.
We've got to have the whole piece of it. We've got to have the whole idea that that what we want to do is we want to the best that we can, want to come together, see the value of each individual, and then try to make the things that are wrong right. And if we do that, I think we'll see a lot of positive growth.
So many places I could go with what you just said. That was so well put. You know, when I think about the idea of one of your wonderful colleagues, Jody, who was in fact, her podcast episode is dropping today. That we are the day we're talking right here, right now.
I'm a huge fan of Jody Luke.
And one of the things she shared was about this idea of bringing joy and reconciliation. And I think that whole part of it's not just making amends, it's even going beyond. And like you said, you can't always restore back to what it was. That will never be the case. Like, you can never go back. Even your own friendships, your own marriage, you know, they change over time, and you can't go back to John in high school with your high school buddies. It's like, but what you can do is you can reconcile in your relationships, and whatever is new, there is this sense of you know, reconciliation. I don't really know. That's such a beautiful word, I think, and a goal in what we're trying to achieve. And there's this word for, I think it's forgiveness in African, I think it's Swahili language, called Ubuntu. I might be wrong. But the whole concept of that, and it reminds me, as you said, is that, so there's this kind of, this example of, you know, the traditional Western way of like, of someone forgiving someone is almost seen in, hey, I'll give you mercy. I'll let you off. You don't have to pay that, you know, you don't have to go to prison, or you don't have to pay that fine. Like, you're forgiven your debt, right? That whole idea of forgiveness of debt is almost like a very transactional thing. Like, oh, I'm free. They forgave me. They might feel really grateful, or they might be like, yes, I got away with it. Whereas in the more African, and probably in a sense many Eastern contexts that are less transactional, this idea of Ubuntu involved, you know, that African person, when they saw you receive their forgiveness for whatever you did, whatever they, you know, you did to them, and they offered that to you, and you agreed to that, they thought you were agreeing to a process of how are we going to work together to be part of the solution moving forward. They were signing up to walking this journey out in a relational way, and I just that whole, like, the meaning of that word just rocked my world. How many times have I just kind of seen forgiveness or seen justice as a line in the sand, when it's really a commitment to a journey of reconciliation, of reparations, of all these things to, you know, again, make something beautiful again.
I love that. Thank you for sharing that. You know, it reminds me of this idea that when we think about reconciliation or forgiveness or restoration, it always points forward to the future. It never points backwards. The idea is not to rewind the tape and go back in time as if it never happened. It means we're going to have a healthy way to actually walk in forgiveness and reconciliation, which doesn't always mean that everyone's back together. You know, if someone's been sexually traumatized by a family member, like, what forgiveness and reconciliation might look like is safely never being with that person again, but still moving forward and not living under the anger and under the pressure and shame that comes along with that. It doesn't mean that we have to get everybody back to their original positions. It means we get to take what happened and we get to transform it into the best possible version of what the future can hold.
Beautiful. And that journey, right, that individual who committed the crime or committed, you know, whatever they did, needs to take a forward journey too, right? And they need to do some hard work. And in most cases, it'll be the same with the victim, you know, their journey forward. And I love that. It doesn't always have to be together, but it is a forward-looking thing. Now, I remember we were in Israel together, and that was a fun trip. And I'd love to talk a little bit about, obviously, go back to that trip and some of the, I think there's something about when you visit a place like Israel. We were in the West Bank and even on the Golan Heights, you know, which are, you know, many ways, you know, kind of that cross-sectional disputable territory up there with Syria and Lebanon. And there's just so many layers and complexities to this part of the world. And probably one of the, you know, greatest focuses on how do we have peace? How do we have reconciliation? How do we create a part of the world where there's rights for everyone to coexist and live and flourish. I think if it kind of all zooms into sharp focus there, and it was so much fun traveling through that town, visiting people that are doing incredible works of justice. Amazing. And I remember on one stop we were visiting a friend of mine, and they were doing some great work trying to kind of bring people out of trafficking situations where they were trapped or debts. And I just was so struck by a very thoughtful approach to even helping guide that whole situation, which seemed to be fraught with a lot of different dangers. You know, well-meaning intentions and trying to do good can often unravel and create even more harm to those involved. And I bet you saw that throughout your years with IJM and the work for, you know, addressing those, you know, some really complex situations. Tell me, as someone who's had to be a part of like the broader picture, I love the way you thoughtfully thought, well, how will this play out in other spheres that are influencing, in other systems that are influencing this great injustice? What does it take? Like you seem wired for that, like your thoughtfulness, your contemplation, the way you really process things well. How did you learn that? What has it been like being in the space where that has probably been more part of your role than the on the ground front line, get your hands dirty, pulling people out of brothels kind of role?
You know, I think one of the things that shaped me a lot is just spending time with survivors and listening to them. You know, each one of them is an expert in their own experience, certainly, but also has ideas and opinions about what they experienced. And I've learned a great deal from them, both when I was in India, but also for the 10 years that I was kind of a federal prosecutor in the United States, leading the human trafficking prosecution unit for the Department of Justice, all sorts of labor and sex trafficking cases in the United States, and then, of course, our work internationally. Listening to victims has made a huge difference. But one thing that might surprise you is I've also spent a lot of time with traffickers and listening to them and understanding how they see their crime, how they decide who they're going to recruit and groom and coerce, how they're going to structure the profit margin so they can maximize their ill-gotten gains, what their opinion of law enforcement and judges and prosecutors are, how they value risk. And from both these groups, I've learned different things. And one of them, I think, is to understand that situations are complex, they're difficult, but if we can figure out where the people are within the system, and if we can listen to them, we're probably going to pick up the insights we need to advance the ball, to move things a bit forward. And so when we were in Israel together, you know, for me, that was it was a little overwhelming, that just the layers and layers of history and grievance and frustration and pain and hurt and trauma go in every which direction. I just want peace. I want reconciliation. Getting there is really, really hard, but I think it's going to involve sitting down with people and acknowledging their concerns and their pain and their history, valuing them as individuals, and then charting a course towards something that is not the past, but is instead the future.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And listening to all sides, I like what you said there. There's with even in the case of listening to the trafficking side, in many cases, in most of those that are involved in it didn't necessarily may not have chosen that path or may not have seen many options other than that path, whether they were victims originally. And so this idea of sitting down, listening, and kind of valuing everybody's point of view. Yeah, it's really good.
And valuing everyone doesn't mean that everyone has equally valid opinions. Like the traffickers were wrong in many cases, right? But understanding that they're still worth hearing and they're still worth learning from, we still have to hold them accountable. They still like still have agency, even if they also suffered and had some trauma. Like they chose to hurt other people. Like we have to stop that. So seeing people as inherently valuable, seeing everyone as inherently valuable, doesn't mean that we walk away from accountability. It just means that we understand that when we're holding someone accountable or when a government's holding someone accountable, we're holding an individual that's really important accountable. And that individual has a future too. And what would it look like if we could also guide them into a more hopeful, better life?
Well, the impact we can have can be exponentially greater than sometimes just rescuing one, as important as the one is, as we know. The rabbi we both follow and taught about rescuing one sheep or looking for one coin, the value there is immense. But, you know, in some respects, you know, it's like coming at it from two angles. And maybe it's not just two. Maybe it's without being binary. It's like multiple angles. Like you can come at justice from one angle. You can also come up, you know what, I'm going to come from the side of I want to create opportunities for those that are poor, and poverty might be a great cause or certain other injustices. You know, I would argue that, you know, the state, the way in which we treat refugees and the way in which people are displaced and don't have the freedom to belong in a community creates a huge vacuum for them to be either victims of or become perpetrators of other criminal activity because there's little option for them. We in our systems and in our policies and our roles from governments to individuals with our opinions and perspectives have limited the world or the which we live in that says, no, you belong. You have opportunities like everybody else. And so I love that it's about coming at it from all angles and not seeing it so one-dimensional.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's helpful. And the fun part about that trip to Israel that we had is you helped me see the many dimensions that were within the communities there, whether it was when we were in Bethlehem or Nazareth, whether it was on the at the edge of the Sea of Galilee or in Jerusalem itself. You were really helpful in that.
Oh man, I'm excited. I'll be taking a lot. I think it's a, I don't want to call it a playground, but I do love to have fun. But I want it to be an environment, a space, a place where we can just learn from so many wonderful people. Israel, that part of the world. I mean, the whole world really, ultimately, but there's something particular. I mean, you can be in so many different, you know, just walking through the old city, it's cut into four completely different quarters, you know, one tiny little spot. And within one church, every different faction of denominational religion has their little corner of that one, you know, the Holy Sepulchre church. You've got the Ethiopians over here. And I mean, there's this melting pot of so much in so many levels and can be, you know, to be exposed to that, to experience that can be such a, you know, really enriching process. So I love that. And I definitely have, I'm privileged and blessed to have some pretty amazing friends in that part of the world that, that I guess are like-minded in their desire to see everyone get along. And, you know, I was thinking about what would be my kind of simple kind of takeaway for what is justice and to define it. And it does come back to that phrase I often say often, it's to create a world where everyone belongs, you know, to create a place where everyone has, you know, not only needed, but wanted, you know, like, you know, and if I think if ultimately that could be created, which, yeah, that was part of I know my goal. Yeah.
That really is the foundation, the philosophical foundation of human rights, of all these ideas, is that everyone has inherent value, that rights that do not come from their abilities and do not come from governments and can't be infringed on by others. This idea that these rights are not there because the majority said they are. You know, slavery was democratically approved around the world. You know, for 4,000 years of recorded history, we've had some sort of slavery all the way from the Hammurabi Code, Aztecs, Incas, Greeks, Romans, Hebrews, Chinese, Indians. It's been all over. It's in the U.S. Constitution in three places. You know, it's part of the shameful history of the world, and it's been going on in the slave trade after slave trade after slave trade. Obviously, the transatlantic slave trade gets the most attention because we have the most information about it. But the reality is all of that shifted about 220 years ago, where we got one by one countries saying that the slave trade was illegal. And now, amazingly, in just 200 years, we've gotten every country in the world to agree that slavery is wrong. And in 2014, we had the leaders of almost all the major world religions gathered together in Rome, and they all signed a document that said that their sacred texts shall never be used again to condone slavery. That's 2014. Tim, I have socks older than that. Like, this is recent history. I'm so excited because I feel like there is this momentum. I feel like there is this sense of opportunity and expectancy about what is to come in the next generation because of the work that was done by others before us. But if we really believe that everyone matters, that no one should be the victim of human trafficking, if we believe that every single refugee has inherent value and is special, if we believe that everyone in an internally displaced people's camp around the world, it matters, we will start to behave differently. Our cultures will start to behave differently. We'll start to see people as brothers and sisters in an extended human family and not as someone that we can just dismiss and act like we don't care about.
This episode is brought to you by The Just Travel Company, your socially responsible travel concierge. Just Travel is the best kept secret in culturally immersive and justice-oriented adventures. Allow Just Travel to take the hassle out of your next trip and experience wonder and unearth justice. Discover the just way to travel today. Simply head on over to just-travel.co to learn more and book your next adventure. Like our flagship Israel Istanbul trip launching out in mid-July 2023. Yeah, I love that it starts at our values. It starts at the labels and the way, the language, and that needs to be the starting point. Now, I love that you went there because you've spent a lot of time meeting with heads of state, governments, people making policies, and you know, like you said, you've had this privilege of being able to see all these countries and on all these large institutions acknowledge and work towards that. Call me a little, I love the optimism of that. I'm also someone who likes to be like, well, how do we though make sure these aren't just it's a starting point, but token acknowledgements to maybe just say, hey, you know what? We know that this is what everyone, quote unquote, is signing on to, so we don't want to, you know, appear to be, you know, against that. But really, you know, we still see so many human rights violations all around the world, and I don't really want to pick on any particular country.
Sure.
But because I think once we start with one, we'd end up with almost so many. But I would probably say even in Europe, for example, there's many countries that sign on to, hey, this is what we agree about refugee and migration law, and yet they don't they're still not following through with the commitments they make, or with, you know, look, I'll call out Australia because I'm an Aussie and I feel like I can't hold my own to account a lot firmer, but we've done some despicable things and violations of UN human rights over the last few years in the way we have crafted policies and done backdoor deals in order to kind of hide the grave human rights injustices that we've committed through our policies. Long-winded, I know, but how do we go from tokenism to being held account? Who has the authority to? I mean, is this stuff we leave to just the UN or to other, you know, like, and one, when it's something that becomes it costs us to give people human rights. Mm-hmm. You know, it can be very lucrative to keep people as slaves. It can be very lucrative it can cost you a lot of money to invest in people. Now, I believe it's the best investment. The long-term game is going to pay off way better for everybody. And there is, you know, if you stop and think about value, but for so many people, they're just thinking about the next election cycle. They're thinking about short-term gains. So how do we, I mean, can you solve this magic million-dollar question, John? How do we move beyond it all?
Well, you know, I think one thing I would say is that when dealing with the concern of, are these acts just sort of tokens, symbolic box-checking exercises that don't really mean anything? My first thought is collect all the tokens. Get every single token you can get.
Yeah,
I want every government saying that they're not going to engage in a human rights abuse.
Get it on record.
With on record, and then get another token and get another on record and get more and more and let them add up. And then when they violate that, use those to hold them accountable, to ask those questions, to say, you're now acting inconsistent with the statements that you've made. And I think it can be frustrating for people who are a part of movements for change, because incremental progress being celebrated feels so unsatisfying, right? You know, I think about the women's suffrage movement in the United States. There were a group of women campaigning for the right to vote, and they were pursuing an incrementalist strategy. Let's get it in these elections and in this state and then here and there. And there was another group of activists chaining themselves to the gates of the White House, demanding complete franchise immediately. And they were fighting with each other about their tactics and strategies. Mm. And they felt like if we celebrate the small little victory, then we're in a sense giving people a pass on all the other mistakes they're making. And I think what we've learned is we need the small little victories, and we need to not be satisfied with them. We need to keep pressing. And so when I think about token type responses, I'll take your tokens, and then I'm going to try to get more tokens, and I'm trying to build momentum out of that. And it's a long and steady process. But you know, today we're celebrating the history of Dr. Reverend Martin Luther.
Yes, I was going to bring that up. I'm so glad you did.
It's wonderful. But, you know, when you think about the civil rights movement in the United States, most people mark its beginning in 1954 when an activist wouldn't give up her seat on a bus in Montgomery, Alabama. People criticized them in real time, saying that's just a token. It's just one little thing. It's not going to make a difference. And then guys wouldn't give up their seats at a lunch counter in Greensboro. And they demanded to walk across a bridge in Alabama. And they rode buses in the Freedom Rides. All these little one-off token type efforts towards change. But they added up. And 9 years later, Congress in the United States relented and finally passed the Civil Rights Act, which said that all of this has to change. You know, I think it is those small incremental steps of forcing systems to either start to do the right thing, right, or in the civil rights movement in the United States, forcing it to enforce bad laws in public that would then lose public support and credibility can have a massive impact over time. I think the question for us is, how do we find the right things to go after, and how do, and I think we gather that from the places closest to us, where we look around and see, where are the things that are wrong that I can work to make right? Where's the system that I could challenge in a subtle or intentional way? How can I actually love the refugee? How can I expand my own definition of who my neighbor is, and broader and broader?
I love that. And again, it brings back the multi-dimensional approach. There is the those that address the systemic things, and then those that refuse to get off their seat. And I'm going to stay on this bus, and I'm going to do one act of seemingly, you know, small significance that ends up becoming a marking point in history. It made me think of, in order to kind of redeem my criticism of Australia, it made me think of this Australian at the Olympic Games. I might have to look it up because I don't want to get it too wrong. But you know the infamous photo of the sprinter from America, the black sprinter who holds his hand up with, you know, black power, and solely beside him was an Australian on the second place or third place podium. I think the third or second place podium was vacant. But that one act drew lots of controversy to that Australian to stand up, knowing he knew what was going to happen. He knew what ahead of time, what political demonstration would be made in that act. And he chose to stand in solidarity with him in that moment. And again, we can debate to the cows come home, the right way or the wrong way. There's internal conflicts of, like you said, within the civil rights movement. And, but just, you know, for me to see and read the story behind his act of solidarity with somebody else. So it's one thing for someone to take a stand for their own rights. I think it's even another thing to stand alongside in solidarity with others who need that, deserve that support and in their quest for freedom. And I'm glad you brought up Martin Luther King, you know, because how cool is that, right? The podcast launches for season 3 today, Martin Luther King Jr. And also to have you on is, you know, interviewing you will be released later on, but to have you on is such a joy. But, you know, in that messy fight towards justice, in that messiness of figuring it all out, people get it wrong, you know, and I don't necessarily think, you know, I think there's people that are brazenly wrong and they know it, and or they've not known anything else. They just haven't been educated enough. They haven't haven't experienced enough. And that's why I think having experiences and travel and learning and sitting and listening at the feet of people that have experienced injustice can do a world of wonder for opening your eyes up. But I'm going to personalize it. Can you think of a moment when you got it wrong, or you've had to kind of say, you know what, I'm going to have to change my approach because for all the reasons I thought this was the right way or this was the best way, let's say, I now know different. You know, I think I have them all the time. I could be such a passionate idealist person for trying to bring change. And I'm like, man, I just got that so wrong. You've even made me think by when you kind of referred to like listening to traffickers, you know, and I think you said it in a very thoughtful way that didn't kind of justify them, but like maybe that's a part of it. But just by going on one side isn't always the answer. But can you think of some moments or a moment?
Oh, you know, so many times I feel like I get things wrong. You know, in the space of trafficking, I think we can think of several really clear examples. you know, in the early days of this movement, and it really started in 2000, right? That's when we got the Palermo Protocol from the United Nations.
Oh, Palermo, you hear about sorry to interrupt, but the mafia boss from Sicily in Palermo just got arrested by the Italian police. They've been chasing him for like the highest scalp in the mafia has just been kind of nabbed.
I did not hear that.
Yeah.
Breaking news, right?
Breaking news. I woke up to it. Anyway, Justice Matters, reverse to report. But sorry, the Palermo Protocol. Is that a reference to Palermo, Sicily?
It was. It was the United Nations Trafficking in Persons Protocol was adopted at a meeting there.
Yeah.
And so that happened in 2000. It really marked the beginning of the trafficking movement. And a few NGOs popped up and were trying to do some work. And in the early days, you know, we were just trying to identify victims and see if we can help them, see if we can make sure the government systems that are in place would do their jobs. And, you know, I remember so clearly one of the first operations that we did with the Indian government in southern India, and we were at a rock quarry, and 89 people representing five families were declared freed and no longer forced to work at this rock quarry. And the judge was there and he issued these certificates individual to each one of them saying that they were now free. And then the question came up is we freed them. The government has freed them from something, but what are they freed into? We didn't have a system ready in place about how do you provide protection and care for people that have been the victims of these crimes. And so we had to sketch it out really quickly, but it took weeks. And over time, the organization developed good systems and thoughtful long-term aftercare type programs. But we didn't have that on day one. We didn't have that ready to go. And so we would be taking trips on an overnight train back down to their village every week to bring them rice and oil and the basic provisions. They've been blacklisted by the community. Wow. They couldn't buy provisions. They couldn't get other jobs. And one day I was becoming discouraged. Like, what are we doing? Have we helped these people or have we made their lives worse by our intervention? And so I asked through an interpreter, I said, do you all ever think about selling yourselves back just so that you would have a meal or two a day? And this fellow in the back who had never said a whole lot, he had a bushy white hair, I remember. And he said very quietly, I would rather die than ever be a slave again. And I just felt so humbled in that moment. How could I have even asked the question? And what struck me as I took the train home was that death might be an option. He doesn't have, you know, a credit card to go out to dinner that night. The options were not clear. I can tell you that we worked really hard. I was reading Indian criminal procedure and realized, hey, if something is used as an instrumentality of the crime, it could be seized in asset forfeiture. So we seized it. We got the government to take the rock quarry where they were forced to work and sign it over the real estate to those 89 people
who are now the owners
of the quarry they used to be forced to work in. But here's the thing we had to talk to them about is make sure you don't force people to work in this quarry now, because that's what they knew. That was their mindset. In a sense, the power
structure. The model they were handed.
The model they were handed. It was what they had known. But beginning to break those cycles and realizing, you know, like we've got to do this differently. We've got to approach this differently. I would say though, because I think it's not hard, I think, for people to find places where they've been wrong. I worry that the fear of being wrong keeps people from taking action. Like the reality is, anybody who tries to go do something is going to make mistakes. No one plays a sonata perfectly the first time. It's years of practicing their instrument. Everyone stalls a car the first time they're trying to drive it with a manual transmission. Right? Like you have to learn. If we don't want the fear of making
What, you stalled a car when you were learning to drive?
And believe it or not. But we want to be open to changing our language, changing the way we speak as we learn new things. One thing in the anti-trafficking movement that you'll see is in the early years, people talked a lot about rescue. And as we listen to survivors, we learned that they don't particularly care for that. Like, they're not, they don't think that they're the damsel in distress and yeah, we're the great savior fixing
Prince
everything.
Prince in shining armor.
100%. You know, and I don't think the people who use that word were trying to communicate that, but it's how it was received. And so you'll see the anti-traffic movement has largely moved away from using that word. Just like subtle changes. Like, can we just stay really, really faithful to the most important things? Like, on the big things, we're gonna have unity. And then on everything else, on all the small things, on the things that are debatable or disputable, could we just have lots of charity for each other? And make some quick adjustments so that we can keep focusing on the most important mission at hand.
No, I love that kind of that let's be more forgiving. And it kind of comes back to that being generous of spirit. We're all trying, especially in this space, trying to make a difference, trying to do something. And it's nothing, it's to throw the kitchen sink at somebody that use a word wrongly when we all know the intention behind that. And it's important that language changes. It's important. I mean, I'm advocate. I did a TED talk on not calling refugees displaced and illegal immigrants and all these things because, you know, I believe they're waymakers. And I think there's a lot more positive language around that. But I even catch myself using those words from time to time because I'm trying to convey something or kind of say something. And I think in a culture today which cancels people for saying the wrong thing without even knowing or going back 20, 30, 40 years to their deep, dark past and pull up something they said wrong in a completely different time, age, and context. You're right. I think, you know, we've got to come together in these things and not be shooting each other in the foot and, you know, kind of find those areas where we might be coming at it from different angles, but we're all got that same goal and hope.
And this is the freedom to the humility to say other organizations can do it differently. They might have a theory of change. I actually don't even like it. I wish they did it like I did it. But the reality is what we need is not everyone playing in unison. What we need are hopefully some harmonies, right? People taking different approaches that can be complementary to each other. And maybe even like we have jazz, you know, a little dissonance every now and then.
Come on.
This idea that everyone has to do it like I do it in order for it to be right is an unhelpful posture.
Yeah, it's this desire to control, right? People, again, in another form of slavery, really, isn't it? in other ways, it's saying I'm going to control how and what and who and where. That one thing that we're all harmonizing to, I love. I think to kind of close things off or bring things, tie things together, I should say, is that one thing we are is that core value of human dignity, no human is illegal, no human, you know, their rights and their value as an individual is given to them aside of all of our other things. And I think that's the one thing we're harmonizing towards. And we play different notes. And I'm so proud to have become your friend and to slowly uncover all the years and years of work you've given and dedicated in both your career, your personal life as a father and husband. I've learned so much from you in my brief times that we've spent together and the opportunities we get to talk. And I love that we are in a way working together on some stuff, which is so much fun in Israel, which is like, watch this space. I'm sure over the next few months, you'll be hearing a lot more of what's being done in that beautiful part of the world. It's a joy to kind of share you with my guests today. So I really appreciate your time, John. We didn't get to your work with Love Does, kind of a quick segue. So right now you're working as the senior advisor to Love Does and the work that they do all around the world in conflict zones, predominantly in places of conflict. And the places that become as we've talked about, very difficult and hard to work in. Share a little bit about your role and some of the things you just love about that role, that hat you get to play, because it's not the only hat you're playing right now. But share with us about that.
I so appreciate the heart of Love Does, which is an American NGO. It's a nonprofit that was started by your friend, Tim, Bob Goff. And he does have a heart for education in conflict zones. But even broader than that, he just has a heart for, like, how could we have a bias towards action? How could we default towards doing something? And not just seeing problems, like, but just quick action. And it may not be action that fixes everything, but what if we could bring some joy to people right now, wherever they are, and begin this sense of movement? There's a lot of NGOs that have unbelievable strategic plans and are trying to move really slowly with this, like, complete package that's going to fix every possible thing. And Love Does just likes to move fast, and they want to be agile and nimble, find people who are doing good work and just explode in with them to expand that work. And so my role is really just to help them on some of their international projects and dream with them about what's possible, help create some relationships and figure out if there's a way to take intentions all the way to action. One thing that Love isn't just going to sit around and talk about things. Love's going to get out there and do things.
Come on, move some pieces.
And that's what you do, Tim. That's what You Belong does. And I think that's what I so love about your heart for waymakers, for people who have been displaced, and to see them as individuals and as valuable. And I think Bob has a similar heart expressed around places where it's just really difficult to operate. So it's been a great joy.
Yeah, it's I can only think about some of the challenges that, I mean, you have to have an appetite for setbacks. And it's not like the places that you're working, whether it be Afghanistan, where you see recently the government not allowing women to work in NGOs and pulling kids out of schools. And I think one of the few female MPs that stayed behind in Afghanistan has just recently been murdered in Kabul. And so you look at places like that, Somalia with all their chaos, and Iraq where we lived and did some work together with Love Does. I mean, you have to have an appetite for things not going to plan, which I think is just so what makes Bob just and the work of Love Does so fit for it, because there's this constant willingness to, as he would say, do a quarter turn. All right, let's do a quarter turn. Let's see what we can make of this. And I think you, as in a senior advisor role and with all your experience and both on the ground, are just such a great fit to help lead and guide the work as it keeps moving forward. So, yeah.
It's a lot of fun. And I can't wait to be with you again. We'll have to get our next big adventure together and
absolutely.
And head out.
When's your next plan to Israel? I'll be there in June with a couple of trips that I've planned to take some folk along and kind of give them the royal tour like I did with you and Bob and Jody and Josiah.
I hope those people know how fortunate they are to get to make that trip in June with you. Everyone should try and get on that.
Yeah, that's so fun. Oh, man. Well, there's spaces available, John. Just let me know if you need me to kind of save your seat on that bus.
Thank you, friend. Thank you.
Hey, I'll let you go. Get outside. Enjoy the weather. Thank you so much. I'll put all the in the show notes places where people can learn about Love Does, follow Love Does and the work, and maybe reach out and get in touch with you. I'm sure there's an email or there's a LinkedIn or some way if people have really kind of – loved learning from you, as I know I do every time, we'll want to reach out. So
awesome. Yeah, I've got a broken website right now, but I'm trying to get it fixed, which is my name. JohnCottonRichmond.com.
JohnCottonRichmond.com.
So it's only half working right now. Evidently, somebody sent me a note. And then I'm on social media, but I've been doing a terrible job this last year on social media. I need to do better. My problem,
Maybe you're real relationships are flourishing.
My problem is I just don't care. I just don't care about it, but I feel like I should. So,
oh, well, yeah, I feel you. I hear you. Well, it's been a joy as always.
It's all talking to you, man.
Yeah. Thanks for making it to the end of another episode of Justice Matters with Tim Buxton. It is an immense privilege to share these conversations and inspiring people with you. To learn more about how you can get involved or learn more about today's guest, head on over to the show notes or episode description. This podcast was produced by the master himself, Jose Villotto, with just a little bit of help from me. The featured music is the song Turning Over Tables by The Brilliance. Lastly, to my Patreon community out there, thank you so much for your support and generosity. Without you, this podcast would not be possible. If you'd like to become a patron and get exclusive access to behind-the-scenes content, visit patreon.com/justicematters and start your Give What You Can monthly contribution today. And join me and so many others in creating a world where everyone belongs. Until next time, thank you for subscribing and sharing this podcast with your friends. Justice Matters with Tim Buxton acknowledges and pays respect to the past, present, and future traditional custodians and elders of this nation, now known as Australia, and the continuation of cultural, spiritual, and educational practices of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples.